Now, on Talk Table on Wednesday night, that's the debate show for 16 to 21-year-olds. One of the questions we discussed was about social class. We asked our panel, is there a snobbery against the working class? Have a listen to what the Ulster Unionist MLA, Doug Beattie, told us.
People do look at you in a particular way. Where do you come from? What do your parents work at?
Would prejudice
what
is, be a better word?
What is your educational background?
So, you know, and they don't see the person for what they are. So I left school at the age of 16 with no educational qualifications whatsoever. I've got no O-levels, GCSEs. I've got no A-levels. I didn't go to university.
I can sometimes tell when I'm interviewing you.
But I made the best I could of life. But then if I look back from that schooling at my social background, you know, I came from a family of six children, two parents and a dog called Johnny who lived in a three-bedroom terrace house where I had to sleep under the stairs. Now, if you're thinking Harry Potter, stop thinking Harry Potter. There was no room. There was no room. So I had to make a bed under the stairs in our house in Union Street in Portadown. That's what it was like. My mother died when I was 14. My father turned to alcohol to deal with his grief. But that did not hold me back. None of that held me back. I have stood before the Queen to receive awards.
It probably made it harder for you.
Yeah, that's...
It did, Stephen, and you're right. The point I was going to say, and I don't want to ramble onto this, but you're right, because it still affects my self-esteem today. It still affects my confidence today. And people can say I've become really quite successful. Well, when people sort of say to you, says, oh, what university do you go to? You must be if you're a politician. And I say, well, I didn't. I left and joined the army at 16 and a half. And you just see the way they look at you, and it affects your self-esteem and your confidence. Sure.
Well, Doug Beattie is with us now. Good morning to you, Doug.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Tell me more, because we didn't get time in the telly. You never do in telly. Tell me more about how you grew up.
Well, Stephen, I'm the son of a soldier, and we moved around an awful lot. But we settled in Northern Ireland when I was quite young, and we lived in a terrace house. We were a big family. There wasn't very much room. I was the youngest of the six, and a bed was made for me under the stairs in a cupboard in my mother's room, and that's purely because space was of a premium. And yes, it was hard, and money was very, very tight, and it was difficult to fit in with community in general. So life was pretty difficult, and my mother died when I was 14, and that has an effect on you as a young man. And of course,
can I stop you there, because sure. I think people know how close I am to my mum. I can't imagine life without her, and I'm a 45-year-old man. When it happened, when you lose your mother at 14, when you're a boy, when you're a child, can you tell me what happens to you?
Well, I guess it's devastating, Stephen, and everybody's very different, I suppose. You know, we came from a very old-fashioned type of family. My father was the breadwinner. He was very aloof from his kids. You know, he would never hug a child. He would never tell me that he would love me or anything like that. So the mother was really the homemaker, and that's the way it was in them days.
Your dad never told you he loved you?
No, he didn't. It's a strange one, Stephen, and I'm not trying to pull anybody's heartstrings, but, you know, as I go on to when my father died, and I was sitting beside him at his deathbed, and he'd lost his throat through cancer, and he couldn't speak, but he had a small notebook. And he wrote it in the notebook and handed it to me, and that was just before he passed away.
He wrote what, Doug?
That he loved me, and that was very moving. And I was,
Was that the first time?
I was in my 40s. Well,
was that the first time in your life that he had told you he loved you when he was dying?
It's the only memory I have of Stephen. Now, it's easy to vilify your father and what he should have done when he was younger, when I was younger, and you know, he should have been far more engaged with us, and it'd be unfair of me to attack a man about that. But it's the only time I remember it was him doing that, and to say he was proud of me, you know. So the loss of your mother is nearly the destroying of your home when you're in a family like that, and of course, you know, my sisters and brothers moved on. The other two brothers joined the army. My other sisters got married or moved out of the home, and I was left in the house with my father, who turned to alcohol, and life was difficult. I got myself in trouble with the police, which I know shamed my father to a certain degree.
What did you do?
You know, this is a story in itself, Stephen, and I know I'll get criticism for this, but I'm more than happy to be very open, because I have been with this. My father was in the Ulster Defence Regiment, having left the Royal Ulster Rifles. He joined the Ulster Defence Regiment, and I found his off-duty personal protection weapon and accidentally shot my best friend in the face. That was a difficult time. It still affects me today, I suppose. But I knew my father was ashamed of me by those actions, which were purely accidental, but you could see how they were shaming.
How old were you during
the military? I would have just turned 15.
Sorry, if this is a well-publicised story, I'm sorry I haven't read it. So
no, that's okay. No, that's fine.
You shot your friend in the face. How?
Well, typical 15-year-old inquisitive young lad who wanted to show off in front of his friends and pointed it at the friend and pulled the trigger and shot him in the face. And you know, he's still my friend, I've got to say. I still see him in Portadown every now and again, and we still talk about this.
What injuries did he sustain?
Well, it was the bullet went in just to the side of his mouth and come out just to the side of his neck, and I was very lucky that it didn't strike bone, it didn't damage any bone or anything like that. But you can imagine when you get shot in the face at near point blank range, it's not ever going to be a nice experience for him, and certainly it wasn't for me. And even now, I've got to say, I cringe a little bit sitting here, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable speaking to you about it, but it happened, and there's no point in me hiding from it. It's just one of those things.
And that feeling, that traumatic event, and of course it was traumatic for him. He was the one got the bullet. I get that. But when you did that accidentally, presumably that's a life changing moment.
It is, and you know, we could talk all day about this, and I guess my mental blocks that I have in life now maybe well stem from that and that period of my mother dying and that incident happening and the reaction by my father and everything that went with it has all affected my life and has tainted me in a particular way. I guess we are all brought up in a particular way, and things in our life will affect what happens, and those things have affected me. But one of the things I did, and one of the reasons I joined the military, and I didn't want to, I've got to say this to you, at the age of 16, was I really had this feeling that my father was ashamed of me, and I wanted to make him proud. So I joined the military at the age of 16, and that's the reason why I joined. I had absolutely no enthusiasm for joining the military whatsoever.
I will move on from it.
Sure.
But that mistake, that accident, do you get flashbacks? I know that traumatic events in life can, you know, just that one moment in life can change you. Did that, you know, are you, has it messed you up in any way?
Well, it's really hard, Stephen, and when I said to you that I'm uncomfortable talking about it, it doesn't mean I don't want to talk about it, but I'm uncomfortable because it brings back very, very strong memories of that particular time. So it clearly still affects me now. It just so happens that I'm now 53 years of age, and my life has been overtaken with multiple traumatic events, I have to say. So, you know, it slides into that same scale with all of the other traumatic events that I've been involved in over many years. But yes, it clearly still affects me. I absolutely can see any issues that I have, and some of the mental health issues that I may well have could well be rooted back to that period of life, that period in time in my life with the death of my mother and that particular incident. But I guess it falls into many, many more traumatic incidents that I've been involved in.
And clearly, Doug, you have the control of this interview in terms of your privacy. But you mentioned mental health issues that you might have. Do you want to talk about those?
No, I mean, I've spoken about these, Stephen, and I think it's really important that I do, and I'm lucky that I can, because so many other people out there cannot. I find myself, as many people do, suffering from mental health issues. I've had a long career in the military, and lots of things have happened to me within that military sphere. I do not have PTSD, and one of the reasons I do not is because I will not allow myself to be labelled in any shape or form. But the reality is that I do struggle at times with mental health issues, which could stem well back from my teens.
Anxiety or depression or what?
Well, some of it is clearly depression. It's and depression is really hard to identify. You know, sometimes you just say to yourself, Doug, are you just feeling sad today, or are you depressed? You know, so sometimes if somebody else is not talking to you or analysing you, then it's difficult to analyse yourself. So sometimes I go into a position where for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I just feel really, really sad. Now, some people may say, well, that's depression, Doug. Well, I'm not self-diagnosing myself. I just say that I'm really, really sad at times. And I guess, you know, I said, and you asked about flashbacks, and I never use that term, flashbacks, you know, but I can look back on my life, and there's moments in my life where I can still see it, I can still smell it, I can still hear it. It's all still live with me, and it makes me uncomfortable, and it makes me sad, and it brings on those periods of time where I'm not the best person necessarily to be with.
What's it like, Doug, to have a father who you think is ashamed of you? Like, did he ever say that out loud?
No, he didn't.
Why did you think it?
Do you know the way somebody interacts with you? Just that absolute aloofness where you just don't get that hug, where you just don't get somebody saying, oh, well done, look how great you are, look what you did. You know, you just never really got that. And therefore you felt that there was something missing from the relationship. And as I was going to say, when everybody left the home, I was kind of left in the home with just my father, who'd turned to alcohol. And the alcohol was to cover his grief. So he would wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, where he was listening to old records that him and my mother used to listen to. And he was clearly drunk, and he'd bring me down. And, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, he would talk to me about these records that he listened to with my mum, you know, Slim Whitman, things like that. And then at 7 o'clock, I'd get up and have to go to school already tired before I even reached school. You know, but there was never that time where I felt that he looked at me and went, I'm really, really proud of you, or I really, really love you, or I'm glad that you're my son. And if I can just maybe fly on a little bit, Stephen, in 2007, Her Majesty the Queen awarded me the Military Cross, and she pinned it on. I was very proud of that. And I remember going to my father and talking to him about it. And he didn't even acknowledge that. He went straight to talking about his life and what he had done and the others in the family. You know, so I always felt it right up till his death that I was maybe not quite good enough for him.
And if you think that you're not quite good enough for your dad, does that mean you think you're not quite good enough in life? Does that follow?
Well, it does follow. And you can look at a family dynamic, or you can look at a social dynamic. And I said this on your show, is that it's a lived experience. And people, there'll be people out there who will know this, people who are very, very successful, who are very, very good at what they do, but yet somewhere they feel that they are not good enough. And I've said this to my staff. My staff sometimes look at me here and I say to them, do you know what, I must be the worst politician ever. And they're saying, you're not, you're good. But there's a real doubt within me that stems from my upbringing. And I have a real confidence issue with myself and my abilities. And that manifests itself even today as a 53-year-old man who's a representative. But part of that is a good thing as well, because it keeps me grounded. It makes me understand how other people think, and I understand that it's not just success is not everything. And you'll know this: just being successful doesn't mean that your life.
I don't think I am successful.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, you answer it, and everybody will look at you and say, "Well, actually, Stephen, you're extremely successful," and I'll say that as well. But it's what you feel which is really, really important.
Exactly. I'm not saying that glibly. I think we all have. I think we all have markers in life to define success, and I've said this before. I think. Success and being successful, it's actually it's a very provocative thing to certainly to say to me, because I don't think I'm successful. But that's another story.
And nobody can take that away from you, Stephen, because that's a lived experience, and you will know what is holding you back from what you feel you've achieved and what you've not achieved. And I guess I'm in exactly the same way, and I think in some cases it's because of my social upbringing or my family background and things like that. I'm a very lucky man, and I'm a lucky man. I've done well in life compared to an awful lot of people who have been held back even more. But that doesn't stop the feelings that you have.
Listen, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us, Doug. Thank you very much,
sir. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Claire Bailey was also on the Top Table show, the Green Party leader. Good morning to you, Claire.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And what struck me that I didn't have time to get into was when you told me that there was a period in your life where you lived in a hostel through lack of money, right?
Yeah, just was made homeless through the private rental sector, given 28 days notice to quit my house. Yeah, and 28 days later, I hadn't secured any new premises and no new home, and had to go and present myself as homeless to the housing executive.
Were you on your own?
No, I had two children, still have two children, but they were a lot younger at the time. So I was actually a student, full-time student at Queen's at the time, so I was about to start my final year. My son was doing the transition from primary to secondary school. My daughter was going into P7 and coming up to having to get her head down and sit the transfer tests.
And what was that like? What was the hostel like?
Oh, it was awful, to be honest with you. I mean, it was clean and people were nice and we had all our space and it was a self-contained flat that we had. There's nothing worse than, I mean, you have to go back, yeah, even just talking about it like this, you go back into that trauma. I mean, having to go down and speak to the housing executive and present myself as homeless and them then talking me through the process. And I felt that it was homeless through no fault of my own. I thought I'd been a very good tenant. And the reason that the notice to quit was given was that at the time there was quite a substantial rent hike had happened. So rents in the area in general, including my own, were going up an extra £50 a month. So my rent for the house was £600 a month and I was living on the student loan. And I really couldn't afford that. You know, I was already stretched in terms of budget and income. So I asked if I could have, instead of signing a new annual lease for the property, could I have a month-to-month while I look for somewhere else? And they refused and gave me my 28 days. So it was hard to find somewhere else within a budget that I could afford at the time. And it was actually the irony of it. I had 6 months before just booked our first ever family holiday and we were heading off to Crete for our holidays. And we were going at the end of June, just as the school year was finishing. So I was given my notice to quit, had to go down and present myself as homeless to the house executive. And they came and lifted all my furniture from the house and put it into storage. And we were heading off to Crete the next day on our holidays. And I remember sitting in the empty living room on a suitcase, just thinking, what do you do now? So we went on our holiday. And we came back from Crete on the 12th of July that year, and I landed back in the airport with my two children, but had a quiet 2 weeks and nowhere to live.
And has poverty prevailed through a lot of your life?
Absolutely. I was born into a very working class family. The house that I was born into was a two up, two down with an outside toilet and no bathroom. But we moved out of Belfast and up into Antrim in sort of mid to late 70s. And I remember when we got the new house in Antrim, it had a bathroom, it had a garden, it had a central heating and it was grand. And my dad had a car, a company car at the time, and he used to drive us up. My sister and I sat in the back of the car all excited, but we were in our swimming costumes and our wee, you know, swimming caps. And we used to play in the bath, thinking it was a swimming pool, while my dad was decorating the house for us to move into. But there were good times, you know. I don't look back on poverty as a traumatic thing in itself. You know, it's another way of living. You know, and the communities that I have always lived in have always been really strong. They've always come together. They've always supported and helped and looked out for each other. You know, so I never felt that I was missing anything, or there was never any shame or stigma with it. It was just the way it was, you know. And then growing up, 70s and 80s. Housing estates, you had the whole Thatcher era there as well, mass unemployment, you know, so it's very reflective of, I think, a lot of issues that we're still facing today. But when I had my own children, became a mother, I've been a lone parent for most of that time as well. So I've repeated, you know, that sort of pattern too. As a mother, I lived on benefits, state benefits for huge amount of times as well. I had two children and childcare the childcare cost just made it impossible for me to have a job where I could afford all that and private rental.
And now you're the leader of a political party in Northern Ireland. Doug and I were talking about this word success earlier on. Do you feel successful?
No, not at all.
Why not?
And it goes back to what you just said there as well. You know, why do you not feel successful? It's how you measure success. What is it? There's still a lot that I want to do in life. And getting into politics was a big decision for me as well. And the reason that I decided I would step into to that arena was really because I was angry. I was really not happy with listening to the political rhetoric, the social policy, the decision making, the narrowness of where we were. You know, the experiences that I have had in my life, I never felt were being addressed at a political level. And I often say to people, even when I was younger, before we had the peace process and institutions up and going and had that sort of avenue, I used to look at politics on the TV, and in my mind's eye, it was very sepia tone, and it was just a lot of men just speaking stuff that I didn't understand.
Claire, I'm sorry, but we've got to leave it there to go to the news this morning, but thank you so much. Interesting insight into Doug and Claire there.